Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's event is co-sponsored by the Center for the Art of Translation, which promotes international literature and translation through publishing, teaching, and public events. And I would like to personally thank Margaret Halbin, who's on the board at the center, for introducing us to this great possibility. We are just delighted to have these speakers here today. The center publishes Two Lines, an annual anthology of international poetry and prose, specializing in works that have not previously been translated into English, and exceptional new translations. Its education arm is Poetry Inside Out, a literary arts program that fosters imagination and builds students' problem-solving, critical thinking, and literacy skills through the translation and composition of poetry. And the center's public event series is called Two Voices, events like this one tonight that feature international authors and translators presenting thought-provoking literature from around the world. Tonight we're privileged to have Stephen Murray and Tina Nunnally, prolific translators of Scandinavian crime fiction. Stephen and Tina have been producing award-winning translations since 1984, including books by Henning Mankell, Peter Hoeg, Camilla Läckberg, and Norwegian Nobel laureate Sigrid Undset. Stephen is the translator of the Stieg Larsson Millennium Series trilogy, and Tina is known for translating another runaway bestseller from the Danish, Smilla's Sense of Snow. Interviewing them will be local radio host Sedge Thompson of KALW's West Coast Live. Following the interview, there will be time for questions, as I said before. We regret, however, that Stephen and Tina are not available to sign books. The books can be signed at a special reception later this evening at the Book Club of California, for which a limited number of tickets are still available. Please see a center staff member if you're interested in attending. Who wants to identify themselves there? Brent, and there's another staff member in case you'd like to attend that after this. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Sedge Thompson, Stephen, and Tina.
Good evening, and great to see you all here on behalf of the Center for Translation and these two fine writers and translators. I would like to know who here in this room has not read the Stieg Larsson trilogy.
Oh, there are a few.
One, two, three. Well, we won't give the plot away. But it involves Apple laptop computers, I can tell you that. I suppose if he went to book 10, Stieg Larsson, he might have moved into the iPad as a...
Never know.
First of all, how did the two of you meet? I mean, you're a married couple. You translate all these amazing books from around the world.
All right, I'll tell the story. I was working for Scandinavian Airlines in Seattle, but I had, before that, studied at the university in Scandinavian Studies. I was working on a doctorate. And I went to a conference on Scandinavian literature to hear someone else who happened to be on the same panel as Steve. And afterwards, he had talked about running a small press, so I went and asked him for a job as a translator, and he was not interested at all.
In the work or the person?
Well, I wasn't too sure, but then I was speaking Danish to another guest who was the cultural attaché who had come out from D.C., and I was speaking Danish, and Steve told me afterwards that it was because I spoke such good Danish that he decided to ask me out for lunch.
That's right.
That's good. And you understood Danish perfectly well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What? How many languages do you know fluently, Stephen?
Well, I don't know. What can you say? I know all the Germanic ones pretty much. And dabble in Spanish and Little Russian, things like that.
Just a few things. And what is your household
translated
language?
From five.
What is your household language?
Well, we speak English, but if we're out and about, we live in Albuquerque, so there's a good chance that no one really speaks Danish there. So if we wanted to talk about something we don't want anyone else to know, we might speak Danish. When we used to live in Seattle, that was a little more problematic because there were a lot of Scandinavians. So, yeah.
So Fjord Press, you eventually ended up together. I mean, you've written novels of your own.
Yes.
You had a very exhilarating time working as an independent publisher before, I think, as you put it, you decided to let somebody else bother about the printing and distribution.
Oh, I hadn't thought of calling it exhilarating. It was certainly expensive.
But what did you hope to do with that press? What did you hope to bring into the world?
Well, we wanted to both bring in some new, mainly Danish authors, a few German, and nobody had ever heard of. And then we got into doing the classics. And we just rifled the classics of Scandinavian literature as much as we could because they were public domain and we didn't have to pay anybody for the rights. But that was just ideal for a small press.
And so you had to have a bit of a business sense to be a translator. One of the other aspects of
being...
I wish we had had a business sense. We never made any money at Fjord Press. But since then, we've had to acquire a business sense because translators don't have agents, so we have to negotiate all of our own contracts. And that takes a lot of experience to get a good contract.
One of the... I remember being in a reading group in the 80s and reading Smilla's Sense of Snow, and one of the... It was a group of writers, and one of the refrains was the author's use of language. And it just occurred to me that, in fact, it wasn't Peter Hoeg's use of language. It was your use of language, Tina.
Thank you.
And in a way, the author kind of freaked out to sort of find himself on the world stage. Didn't quite understand what you were doing in the translation. I mean, what were the issues when you bring somebody's work into a world? I mean, in essence, a sort of an alien land, an alien landscape.
Well, we always like to say that our first loyalty is to the book, not even to the author, certainly not to the publisher, and maybe not even to the reader. Our first loyalty is to the book because we have to give you the book in English. And so we take this, it's a very big responsibility because if you have a poor translation, you can ruin an author's chances to come out into the world. And we're talking about so-called small languages, Danish, Swedish, Norwegian. For those authors to get into English is a very big deal. All of a sudden they have a huge audience instead of just, you know, several million people who can read their books. So we take it very seriously. And we also like to say that it's kind of like a musician playing a piece. You know, it's an art. It's definitely an art. It's not a science. And so we have to listen to the music of the book and hope that we can then convey it to you as the reader as close as possible to that original sound that we had in our head when we read it.
So Smilla's Sense of Snow, here by that title, was called what in the UK?
In the UK, it was called Miss Smilla's Feeling for Snow, which is actually closer to the original Danish title, but does not sound quite so good in English as Smilla's Sense of Snow, at least in my opinion.
And, Stephen, for the title of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, it was in the original Swedish known as...
Men Who Hate Women. Which is really the theme of the whole trilogy.
And how was this received with the idea of, you know, coming to, say, an American or an English audience? I mean, that kind of title of the book.
Well, obviously, the British publisher did not receive it well. He probably thought it sounded like Men Are From Mars or some kind of self-help book, or maybe a psychobabble book. But he decided he wanted to have a series with the girl, you know, going through. Instead of women, of course, it had to be the girl. And so he took the second title, which really was The Girl Who Played with Fire. And then he altered the first and third titles. It's a fifth series idea.
The third title about the hornet's nest was something about the castle in the air collapsing?
Actually, it was something like the castle in the air that was blown up by Elizabeth Solander. So.
That doesn't work.
Kind of an unwieldy title.
When you how did you first come in touch with the publishers and were sought out to translate the trilogy?
Well, I had known the foreign rights head at Norstedts in Stockholm for many years, and we'd worked together but never found a project where we could work together on. And then she retired, and they got a brand new foreign rights manager. And then these books came in, just fell into their lap. And soon thereafter, Stieg died. And they also sold the movie rights to Yellowbird Films located in Ystad. I think Henning Mankell is one of the partners there. Or finance
Ystad is
guy.
The setting for the... The Wallander Mysteries, yeah. Mm-hmm. So kind of a coincidence you must have enjoyed.
Yeah. Well, I had done three of Henning Mankell's mysteries before that. So they knew who I was. And they called up and said, we need three books translated really fast. How fast can you do them? I said, how long are they? They said, 600-700 pages each.
You've described...
Can you do them in 3 months? I said, no. How about 9?
You've described them as sort of a stack of 2,700 pages.
Yeah, in manuscript. Right.
All right,
double-spaced.
Double-spaced. Oh, that's a relief.
Yeah.
When you first took a look at this this manuscript, at what point did you feel this is a really fine... story. This is going to be good. And did you do you leaf through the manuscript, sort of looking at what problems might be ahead, or do you just sort of take it on?
No, not at all. I just read a few chapters, see if it's a style that I can replicate, something I'd be comfortable with doing. And I read maybe 150 pages, and I was totally hooked, like most people.
Did you read it at the same time, Tina?
No. I didn't read it until since we do the same languages, it's really fortunate we can edit each other's work. So I didn't read it until Steve had finished the first draft, really. And then,
how did he describe it as you were going along over breakfast?
Well, the one thing that we both thought about Stieg Larsson's writing is that he had a very American, not so much attitude, but an American way of writing, of expressing himself. The Swedish was so close to American English that we thought this will be really good in American English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a big expert on American science fiction and mysteries.
Yeah.
Also British, but he seemed to prefer American. Not having met him, I don't know, but definitely from his writing, he loved to use American phrases, which he threw into the book in Swedish. Now they're invisible, of course, because it's all in English. But
otherwise, they stood out like italics or print.
Mm-hmm.
When you were translating it, I mean, there are some certain words that show up in the book, forsooth and anon.
Not yours. No, not gallimaufry either.
So what were these words doing in a book that you translated?
Well, those were inserted by the British editor, who is from Scotland originally. So he has a few archaic notions about what sounds good.
And... Is this
forsooth? I mean,
forsooth.
Who says that?
You know, some Swedish hunk. I don't know.
Actually, I did find out later that they do say "see you anon" in Scotland. So it's still a word that's in use.
Right.
Amazingly enough.
So how did that relationship go? I mean, you've worked through 2,700 pages. You have a sense of how the book is to sound, the tone, where you place the language, and then you find out that somebody's been changing words behind your back.
Well, that took that didn't happen for about at least 6 months afterward. After I heard that a British publisher had bought it instead of an American that I had hoped would buy it and retain the American flavor. And so he sent me 135 pages with his editing and said, take a look at this. Well, what do you think? And I just... totally hated most of it. So I said, well, this is going to be a problem.
And so what did you do about it? What could you do about it?
Actually, I made a mistake there. I didn't write back immediately and say I hated it. So I just let it ride, waiting for the rest to show up. Didn't show up. And then in August, they emailed me and said, well, we're going to the printer next week. I said, what? I haven't seen the rest. They said, well, we assumed that you approved of it since you didn't say anything about the sample that they sent. So I said,
so
well,
there was
unfortunately,
a change.
I didn't.
So, but there was a change that you made then for right. your own interests about the translator's name.
Oh, yeah. Well, we went back and forth trying to figure out what to do about this, and he said he could give me 10 days to look over the first 700 pages there and argue about every tiny thing he changed. And I said, you know, I have another book due in 2 weeks, so I don't have time to do this. So eventually I just said, well, forget it. I'm just going to have to use a pseudonym because this, to me, it doesn't represent my work, and I have a reputation to protect, and as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't represent Stieg's tone, which I found to be very American.
And so what name did you choose?
So I chose Reg Keeland.
And where'd that come from?
actually, we had done a book in the early 90s. Our first Swedish translation was a thriller, and a large nameless New York house had edited about a fourth to a third of it out. They thought the author was too repetitive. And, you know, they took out stuff that didn't matter, like the main character's motivation. So we made up a name for that one, Thomas Keeland, because we were embarrassed to say this, say this was a translation. It was just a version now. And Keeland comes from our hometowns, the last syllables thereof, Milwaukee and Oakland. There you go.
And you sometimes, Tina, write under the name of Felicity David.
Felicity David, that's one of my translator pseudonyms. Let me just say, first of all, that we don't really like having pseudonyms because we really think that translators should get credit for their work. And we work hard to get credit for translators. But occasionally we do feel like we have to take our names off the book if it doesn't represent our work, if it's something serious like that. So anyway, yes, Felicity David. I've done three novels, translated three novels by Karin Fossum, who's a Norwegian crime writer. And I used Felicity David because the publisher told me ahead of time, this was for a British publisher originally, and they told me ahead of time that they were going to edit it heavily. So I was glad to know that so then I could say, well, that's fine, and here's the name that I'd like to use.
And when you you translated a Nobel Prize laureate and changed really the reputation of this writer who had been translated into very archaic, almost middle age language as in Middle Ages, and then you brought it up to date in some way that sort of revivified. Could you tell us about this laureate, this writer?
This is Sigrid Undset, Norwegian woman writer, one of the very few women writers to win the Nobel Prize. I think there are only 12 so far. So I was really disappointed to see how badly her work was represented in English. And this was, Steve was the one who pointed it out to me. He said at one point years ago, he said, have you ever looked at Sigrid Undset's Kristin Lovren's Daughter and how it's actually written in Norwegian? I said, no. And so I looked at it and I was just appalled. The original translators decided that since it's set in medieval times in Norway, that the language should reflect that in some way and it should sound archaic. But that is not how Sigrid Undset wrote it. She writes this beautifully clear, straightforward Norwegian. And so for years, people have told me that they just couldn't read that book, even though they thought they should, because she won the Nobel Prize. And so I was really thrilled when Penguin called me up out of the blue and asked me if I would do a new translation. And I was thrilled to do that. And I hope that, well, I know it's a lot closer. I hope that people can see that. There's a really interesting debate on Amazon between the readers, you know, when readers can write reviews. And there's a really interesting debate about the old versus the new Kristen Lovenstutter translation. Some people absolutely hate my version of it and say that I've modernized it. Well, you know, if you read Norwegian, you know I haven't modernized it. I've actually just brought it closer to the way it was. But I think it's interesting for a translator.
Can I give an example?
Oh, sure.
So this is, but elsewhere in the Dale, 'twas not the use for the master's woman folk of the great manors to abide themselves at the satyrs. Kristen knew that if she did it, there would be talk and wonderment among the folks. In God's name, then, they must even talk. Sure it was they that gossiped about hers and hers, whether or no.
You can hardly read it.
Read your translation, then.
Oh, good.
But elsewhere, it wasn't customary for the women of the gentry on the large estates to go up to the pastures. Kristen knew that if she did so, people would be surprised and would gossip about it. Kind of a different. Yeah.
So, which in your view, then, is authentic? And represents the author's or the book
well,
because that's what you want.
No question. There's no question about it. I mean, I just can't even believe that's probably the worst translation I have ever read is the original English translation of Kristen Lovenstutter. And it doesn't make any sense to me because the translators had to first translate it from Norwegian in their minds into their own modern English, and then they had to take another step and translate it into this archaic language, which they made up. It's not even a real medieval language, which would have been a better choice.
It's like a fake Elizabethan, really.
Yes, it was a totally fake, artificial language. And I just, you know, I once wrote an essay comparing translation to art restoration. It's kind of like you try to get rid of the old dirt and dust that's accumulated on some of these classics which were poorly translated originally and hope that you can get down to the real painting so you can show people what it's supposed to be.
What does your writing studio, your translating studio look like? What kind of reference books do you have there, maps?
We have, our house is full of books, of course. There are books everywhere. We keep building more shelves and then surprisingly there's no more space, so we have to build more. For a while, we had to collect a lot of reference books, and this was before we could use the internet for a lot of research. So I collected a lot of horticultural books, for example, because the Scandinavians love plants. They love flowers, plants, and you can't just get by saying a yellow flower or blue or some kind of house plant. You have to actually find the name. So it was, it can be a lengthy process where you have to first get the Latin and then go into English. And sometimes it's hard to find some of these plants because they only grow in certain small valleys in Norway, for example.
And Stephen, in your study, do you listen to music while you write, while you translate?
Quite often, yeah.
What do you like to listen to?
I like listening to stuff without words. Unless it's some old, ancient classic rock that I know by heart and don't even think about the words, I can listen to that and work. But usually I listen to jazz.
And then how much time are you able to use your brain to sit in, I imagine, this very intense activity?
Well, I work a very split shift. A little on, a little off, all day long. And if it's getting towards deadline, I will work late into the night. But I always take breaks for meals and maybe a little video break. But basically, you can translate about 5 hours a day before your brain is totally fried.
How far along were you in translating the Stieg Larsson books when you realized you were dealing with a worldwide phenomenon? I mean, what is it sold, 50, 60 million copies now?
Well, I didn't know that at the time.
But did you finish all
three
of them?
I knew it would be a hit in English. I didn't know how big a hit.
Did you finish all three of them before the first one came out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I finished them in, like, November of 06.
And then when you started hearing about the controversy over who owned the material and Stieg Larsson's partner being cut out of the action. I mean, how did you become involved in that in any way?
Actually, I said, well, I'd like to talk to her. So I looked and looked for her email, but she was a very secretive person because they had been the subject of death threats for his work in fighting against the right-wing extremism in Sweden. So it was hard to find. Finally, I ran into it. I don't even remember how, but I wrote to her. And we've been corresponding ever since. And we've had dinner with her a couple of times in Stockholm, too.
What did you learn that may have made you sort of rethink the translation that you had worked on?
Anything?
Rethink it, or you learned something about Stieg Larsson that you hadn't known from just reading the manuscript in your conversations.
Well, after doing the three books, I felt as if I'd met him. I knew him pretty well by then.
Okay. And have you read the fourth book?
No.
That's the one that's trapped on a computer somewhere?
I don't think anyone except Ava has read that.
What about, there's often an interesting trend in books and literature where people want to go on and complete a series. They're not satisfied that the series has ended. They want to keep it going. So people tend to write their own books now.
Yeah, that's too bad. I just heard that H&M, what's that stand for?
The clothing store, H&M. Yeah. They're going to introduce a Lisbeth Salander clothing line.
Yeah.
Or at least a small collection reflective of Lisbeth's style.
They're pre-ripped and everything, you know.
Yeah.
Speaking of Lisbeth, really one of the phenomenal characters of recent memory.
Yeah.
The tattoo, could you describe the tattoo as you understand it from the original Swedish and how it came?
Original Swedish. Well, I don't know if you've seen the cover of the British edition, but they had a picture of a woman lying on her stomach, and she had a little tiny, about this big, a Chinese tattoo on her left shoulder blade of a dragon. I thought, well, that doesn't look much like the type of tattoo I think she'd get, you know. I don't know if you've seen the modern ones with all the pointy things flying off, you know. It would be more like that. Anyway, in the book, it's described as starting on her right shoulder, sweeping all the way down her back, across her butt, and around to her thigh. So it's a gigantic tattoo. And a big investment in pain, I think, went into that. Unfortunately, I have the... Well, I think that the British publishers already had their cover art designed. And so they changed the description of all our tattoos, which was made by Mikael Blomkvist when they were out at the cabin. After they slept together, he was musing on our tattoos the next day and described them all beautifully in Swedish. And then all of a sudden in English it says, a little dragon on her left shoulder blade.
To match the cover art of the book.
Yeah, exactly. So they rewrote it.
When
outrageous. Yeah.
Was there a... You've translated some sex scenes, too. How do you go about doing that? How do you get into the other cultural thing? Do you and Stephen here talk about how you might...
We talk about everything with our translations. You want to answer that?
I don't. But it's not like Warner Brothers cartoonists that used to act out everything out in the courtyard. Don't go that far. So... What would you like to know?
Well, for instance, sometimes the language in the trilogy seemed a little formal.
Oh, right. What you're talking about. Yeah.
Another thing that the British editor did was change most of the names to surnames only of the characters. So you wind up with this very confusing love triangle of Blomkvist, Berger, and Beckman. Now, who can keep track of that? You don't even know which one is the girl. So it should be Mikael, Erica, and Gregor, her husband. I was very careful to keep use of surnames to business scenes, and if people are in bed, they're going to use the first name, obviously. So, why they changed that, I don't know.
When you write your own novels, Tina... Do you think of how they might be translated?
No, I have to say I don't. I really keep my own fiction separate, and I have a totally different schedule than Steve because he's a night person and I'm a really morning person. So lucky for me, because when I get up early, Steve's still asleep, so I have 2 hours where I write. And then the rest of the day I devote to my translation. Now what were we talking about?
Oh. Hot sex scenes. No. Yeah. You're on writing. Do you think about how they would be
that's
translated?
Right. Well, no. But I had the interesting experience as a translator of having 2 of my novels translated into Danish and published in Denmark. And that was a kind of a strange experience because, I didn't want to interfere too much, but I was really curious to see how they sounded in Danish because I could read it. And the first novel I got back... The translator did a really good job, and she had asked me questions along the way. But I did think it was a little too close to English, maybe. And then the second one, I didn't like at all, because the translator never asked me a single question. So she got all of the brand names. She wasn't quite clear what they were, product names, you know. And so it was very odd in the Danish translation because she didn't know that.
What would be an example of that?
I can't remember this, but Steve said one of our friends... It was, yeah, you're talking about Inga. One of our friends translates Ann Tyler's books into Danish, and so she often would write to us and ask us questions. And one of them was, she wrote and said, "What are Rolades?" So those kinds of, you know, tiny little details that a reader doesn't notice, but it's good if they're correct, because then if it wasn't correct, you would notice, and it would stop you when you're reading the book. So we pay attention to all kinds of things like that.
Were you concerned what the Danish translators... contract was, fairness to that translator, in terms of recognition and payment, pieces of royalties?
I have to say no. But, you know, the thing is in Scandinavia, and I think in the UK also, translators get paid library money. It's called library money in Danish anyway, which means that they get paid at the end of each year for how many copies of that book are in the library. They get a certain...
I think it also has to do with circulation.
And maybe with circulation. I'm not quite sure how that works. So it's not as crucial that they sometimes don't get royalties. But here, to make a living as a translator is quite rare. And we're just lucky that all of you like Nordic crime fiction so much because it's paying our bills.
Keep reading it.
Yeah, keep reading.
So why do you think Nordic crime fiction has attracted such a following, and also Nordic crime fiction has got this very strong, at least certainly in Stieg Larsson and in the Wallander, very strong sort of political commentary that goes along. How do you keep up with the politics of the land?
That was started in the 60s by Maya Sjöwall and Per Wahlöö, who wrote a series of 10 novels.
With Martin Beck.
Beck from 65 to 75. And that became kind of the classic format for Swedish mysteries. And everybody since then has wanted to write a series of 10 novels, including Stieg. He had 10 planned. And it's too bad we can't read them.
How do you keep up with current vernacular?
Well, for one thing, I read the Danish-Swedish papers every morning online, so I keep up with what's happening, what's current. And Steve discovered that a great way for us to keep up with local slang, current slang, is to read teenagers' blogs in Swedish, Norwegian, Danish, because if we can't find a word and we can't find a definition, but you can find the context. How is this word used by kids now? And that is fantastic. It's so much fun to read them.
And the amazing thing about these blogs is that they're half in hip-hop English. That's amazing. And also all the words are shortened like they're texting.
Yeah. And with the success of your various translations, are you able to kind of pick and choose your projects? Can you come across a novel that's been written in one of your languages and say, "I'd like to translate that one"?
Not very often, really.
Sometimes. Well, sometimes we will pursue a book. Yeah. Steve discovered Camilla Läckberg, if any of you have read her books from Swedish. she's becoming popular, and Steve's translated four of them, and I've done two so far. But he discovered that she was really, really popular in Germany. This was before she appeared in English. So he tried to find out who the publisher was going to be for the English editions, and then did a sample translation for them and got the job. So sometimes we will actually pursue a certain author that we're interested in. In the past, we took any book that was offered to us because, you know, sometimes it's a job, so sometimes you have to do books you don't particularly care for. But now there are so many books that publishers want to have in English that there is enough work for all of us. There's a small group of us in England and here who do these languages, and now there's enough work for everyone, which is fantastic.
You've each translated books by the same author. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you tell the translations apart? Do you sort of look at one and say, well, Tina, I don't know if I would have done it that way? And you say, Steve, I don't know.
We have a few telltale words that we each like. And if you see those, you can kind of tell who did this one or this section. We have done books together where we can't even remember who did which chapters, you know.
What are your telltale words? What do you like to use?
Oh, I don't know.
Do you know? Do you have some?
No, I'm not going to say. There are some every once in a while. He says, you use that word way too often. But see, that's all behind the scenes. You know, we probably read a book like 5, 6, 7 times before it even goes to the publisher. So we've hashed out all those words that we disagreed on before it goes out the door.
When you were youngsters growing up and reading, say, Don Quixote or Carlos Fuentes or whatever you were reading, were you conscious that they were translations if you weren't reading them in the
Spanish? Sure, yeah. I started translating for fun probably in high school. In fact, I wrote my first poem in German in high school.
That was over good. In Oakland?
Yeah, yeah, Oakland Tech. Yeah. Hey, there we are. Okay.
Did you have a teacher that inspired you in that regard?
Yeah, I had a great German teacher. I think I started German in junior year because before that all they had was Latin, French, and Spanish, I think. But in junior year they offered German and Russian, so I said, oh, I'll take German. And I have German heritage, so everybody in my family always said Gesundheit. I didn't know how to spell it, but that's what you said.
And you, Tina, you had an AFS program a year abroad when you
yes.
were... How old?
I was 17. I graduated from high school, and then I left a month later for Denmark and lived there for a year, and no one spoke English to me for the whole year. So I
And did you know any Danish?
Not a word of Danish. I had studied German and some Russian in high school, but I didn't know a word of Danish before I went, and that was really, you know, that was just a turning point in my life. I loved being there.
Yeah. We have just a few minutes, and I'm sure some of you have questions, and are there special cards being brought up here? How many of you in the room are active translators or have translated something?
Oh, wow.
Oh, how great.
Amazing.
Does any of this sound familiar to you? In terms of-
I hope you're all putting in a royalty clause if you have a hit.
Yes.
Describe that. Describe how you've done that and what that means. Because I think that's important for the world.
Well, it all started with Smilla Since the Snow. Tina tried to get a royalty from R. Strauss, and they said, oh, no, we don't pay royalties to translators. Unless, of course, you're famous, which we found out later. But that was, we like to call that the first house we didn't buy. Because we probably could have got one.
I call it a cautionary tale.
Yeah,
because we lived in Seattle at the time. I used to take the bus to work, and every morning I'd get on the bus, and the whole busload would be reading Smilla Since the Snow. And it was a little bit bitter, I have to say, to know that I wasn't even getting a penny for each book. So we learned never to sign a work-for-hire contract. And we like to, we often talk to young translators starting out, and I like to talk about the business side of it, too, because you know, you are responsible for negotiating that contract, so it's always wise to say, I would like a clause in my contract that I would get a royalty especially if the book, after you earn back the per word, we get paid by the word. So after you earn back your per word fee, then you should get a royalty like an author does. And you know that the U.S. Copyright Office recognizes the translator as the author of the English edition. So we are partners with the author in that book, and we should also benefit from our work and the success of our work. So,
do you find authors support you in that?
Some do. Others don't. They want it all.
Well, a lot of times authors are, you know, they've moved on to the third or fourth book since then, and they just, that's an old book to them. It's not something that they're currently interested in. So.
You have questions then?
Yeah.
So now we'll do the questions from the audience, and I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that we are listening to the translators of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Stephen and Tina, and just interviewed by Sej Thompson. So some of the questions that were asked, Sej has already covered, so I'm sure some of you recognize that your questions were already asked. But here's a great question to start off the next section. We often hear about lost in translation. Do you have any comments about what's gained in translation?
Let's start with Tina on that one.
Oh. Well, to go with that question, people often say, isn't translation an impossible art? And I like to say that it's not impossible. It might be imperfect. But the fact that we can read books from different cultures is so important. I mean, think about what our lives would be like if we had never read Dostoevsky or Tolstoy or Thomas Mann. I mean, we gain such an insight into different cultures and languages and different ways of looking at the world by reading translated books. So I think that when people say it's lost in translation, it makes me a little sad because, yes, it is imperfect, but think how much you're gaining from reading books about different parts of the world.
Yeah, what they're saying is, do you think that there's any improvement sometimes in translation, that you can gain something in translation, just like you said? I mean, I think it's very clear. I mean, I studied Russian, for example. All I could read after many years was a few short stories in the original language, and I really couldn't, you know, do the novels to any justice. So with my bad Russian, it was better for me to read the translation, get much more, and I think it's just another specialized skill that brings, as you said, brings all kinds of things to our attention that otherwise we could not, you know, get through to. That certainly is a great gain in translation.
But wouldn't you have also had a sense of the rhythm of the language and how the original would have sounded and people, you know, the sort of the tone and the emotional flavor of the language, even if you couldn't pierce the novel in that way?
Especially in Russian, the one great advantage is that you understand all the names and can, you know, know who's who and know all the nicknames that are being used because that's something that was all clear. So that's a big advantage. A lot of people, you know, there should be a translation of Tolstoy that uses John and Mary. So I didn't need that, but that's right. So here's another question. I fell hard for Kristin Larensdotter many years ago. Sigurd Undset's detailed description of everyday items contribute a great deal to the reader's firm grounding in this distant world. What is your contribution to that, and what were your challenges?
Well, I did have to look up a lot of words, because she does, although Sigurd Undset doesn't write in an archaic or awkward way, she did do a lot of research for those books, and so she was very careful to have the correct names for cooking utensils and the architecture of the day. So I did have to look up a lot of words and make sure I got that right. But other than that, I felt such an affinity for that book and for the way she writes. I've translated some other books by her too, which is the wonderful thing about being a translator. When you find a book that you really connect with, then you do a much better job and are much more proud of your work because you really want readers to read that book.
Well, we'll do something just personal for a second. Why do you live in Albuquerque?
Steve.
You probably get that in every other location than Albuquerque.
Being from the East Bay, although we do get a little fog and overcast over there, I did 17 years in Seattle, and that was enough.
You didn't triangulate from Milwaukee and Oakland?
No, we lived in Seattle for a long time, and Steve could not stand the weather after a while.
So next question. Do you think that Stieg Larsson had, if you think that he had still been alive, the editor could have changed things more differently? Do you think that the editor would have been held in more control? Good question.
Yeah, I just became the UK editor.
I think the
or
one that
his Swedish
about,
editor.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's the UK editor. Okay. Yeah, I don't think he would have stood for some of the stuff that was done. Mm-hmm. Certainly would have argued about it. And I think he'd probably have a lot of clout, too. Especially if, for example, they were working on a fourth book now. I'm sure he would be dictating the terms.
Yeah, you said that he was familiar with English to a
oh,
large
yeah,
extent,
he
so he could have
excellent
in
English,
and talked
yeah.
to him. Yeah.
Yep.
Next question. Are there any translators that you admire, learn from, leaders in the field? I mean,
yeah, our favorite UK translator is Don Bartlett, who does Norwegian and Danish and would do German if he had a job doing it. And he's really fantastic. He does Joe Nesber, who is starting to make a name for himself here. And I think they're working on his first movie of a book called The Headhunters. Not about the jungle, but about Oslo. And look for that one.
I also admire Margaret Sarah's Pedden, who translates from Spanish. I think she's yeah. really a good translator.
And I also like Stephen Sartorelli, who does the Andrea Camilleri books from Sicily. Fantastic.
I have a. Have either of you tried out for fun Google Translate?
Yeah, actually, before the box set of the Larsson books came out, somebody discovered the emails from Stieg to his editor at Norstedts in Swedish. They didn't know Swedish, so they ran it through Google Translator. It was a scream.
Yeah.
Really funny.
This is an aside on the last question. You mentioned Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. Who's your favorite translator? I mean, do you have a translator issue on that one? Because there are some questions there.
Well,
if you don't want to say that,
no, all. I have to admit that I'm not really a fan of the new translations.
Uh-huh.
I prefer some of the older translations. Steve and I once did a, I hate to say this, but we did a little test. We found that we had six different translations of, I think it was Crime and Punishment,
right.
in the house. So so I sat on the sofa, and Steve sat behind me, and he read the first paragraph of each one, and I said, oh, that's terrible, throw that one out. I like that one. No, I don't like that one. And I have to say that the one I really didn't like was the newest yeah. translation.
All right.
It's very subjective.
Yeah. It is.
As the readers on Amazon.com clearly show.
Yes.
Why has Nordic crime fiction become so popular in English? Besides the fact maybe it's your translations. No, have there been a new group
know.
Of especially good crime writers in the past 20 years? That's the question.
Yeah, I think there have. I've read some of the older ones, and they weren't that good except for the Martin Beck series. The previous ones just weren't top-notch, and now they are, a lot of them.
Great. Okay. Have you ever translated poetry, and is there a difference?
Oh, yes, there's a big difference. I always say that you have to be a poet to translate poetry, because that's a much greater, it's much more demanding. You don't have the room to move around and edit and process it. You have to be so precise, and you have to really have a poet's sensibility, I think, to recreate the poem from one language into another. Robert Bly has a really interesting, it's like a small pamphlet, I can't remember the title, but it's about, he shows you how he takes a German poem and translates it. He shows you the entire process and how he goes from the original to what he ends up with, which is quite far away from the original. But it's an interesting process to see how he did that.
This is an aside from the other one. What about humor? Humor is also considered, there's some funny things from Mark Twain about translating one of his stories into French and then translating it back into English.
Yeah.
So what's lost in humor might also be, but not as difficult as poetry, but what do you do?
Humor is very hard to translate, but yeah. What's even harder is swear words. Because, for example, in Scandinavian languages, all of the swear words that have a really strong impact have to do with the devil. And if you translated that literally, like by devil or something, it would have no impact whatsoever for an English reader. So we normally have to use, in American English, our swear words usually have to do with sex or body parts or God. So I once translated this very vulgar, fun, I thought it was a really fun novel, and I had to make it equally vulgar in English, so I, you know, it was a lot of gods in that book. And the author, his English wasn't very good. He sent me this frantic email. He said, What? Why did you put all these gods in my book? They weren't there in the original. So he had no idea that the impact wouldn't be the same.
So you're saying that to make the book vulgar enough, you had to switch from the devil to God?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Okay, reading, I understand that.
Devil will take it.
Devil take the hindmost, right? Okay, reading Joe Nesbo books, do you know if the name Harry Hole is only in the English version?
No, that's actually the name, but it's not pronounced Hole, it's pronounced Hule.
Oh, there goes that.
Harry Hule. Yeah, so they should really spell it H-U-L-A, I guess. In fact, that is, since his first two books have not been translated yet, it goes into this in detail in the first book because it's set in Australia, and everybody in Australia calls him Hall. He says, no, that's not how it's pronounced. So once that is translated by the great Don Bartlett, then you'll know.
What was it like to work with Henning Mankell? Any stories for us?
Absolutely no contact. Yeah, I sent him, I did the second book, Sidetracked, and we won the Macallan Gold Dagger for that. It was the first time, I think it was the first time a translation had ever won for the best novel published in Britain that year. And, of course, all the British authors were up in arms. But I sent him an email. I think he was in Mozambique. He spends half the time in Mozambique and half in Sweden. And I said, congratulations, we won the... the Gold Dagger. No answer. And I have met him a couple of times at book fairs, and he's a very shy guy and doesn't really enjoy doing promotion anyway.
But has he ever said thank you?
Not really.
I mean, because it's through the work that translators do that he's found this, and that you and your wife have done, that has helped him find a large American readership.
Yep. What can I say?
Scandinavian reticence. Huh?
Yep.
Another technical question. How do you get permission to retranslate a book? Don't publishers feel, oh, well, it's already in English, even if it's bad? You know, I mean, do you talk somebody into it? Or you gave one example where the publisher came to you and said, it's time to redo this.
Well, in the case of Sigrid Undset, those three novels, the Kristin Lovensdatter trilogy, came into the public domain, or was in the public domain, so that's why they were willing to invest in a new translation. But translation is very expensive, and publishers, they don't really want to pay the extra cost. You know, they wish that all the authors in the world would write in English, so they wouldn't have to pay for that extra cost. So it is rare for a book to be retranslated.
Well, Tina had shopped that one around to several other publishers, including the publisher of the old edition, trying to get them to spring for a new translation. She did a big sample and sent it to them, and they said, well, yeah, okay, it's better, but, you know, we already have a best-selling book that's never been out of print in 75 years, so we don't want to spend the money. And then when Penguin approached her about doing it, I think that was a year or two later, she says, I just happen to have a 60-page sample.
All right, well, we have time for one last question, and it's a request to let us know what you each read in your leisure time, if you do read anything else, and who your favorite authors are for both of you.
Go. We read all the time. We have stacks of books all over the house. Ooh, favorite author. Well, I mean, I love to read mysteries. So that's why we like translating them too. But you know, we never read the book ahead of time because we want to be surprised by the book as we're translating, just like you are when you read it. So we read mysteries all the time. I like biographies a lot. We just read all the time.
Yeah, right now I'm into the new Murakami book, which I highly recommend. Fascinating. And I like to read stuff from different countries. I really like Camilleri's Sicilian mysteries. They're really great. And what else? I also read some popular American stuff, Lee Child and John Sanford I just got into. We learn a lot reading this kind of stuff.
Because you're in the know, what's next coming out of Scandinavia we should look for?
This is one Tina's doing. I don't know when it's coming out. It's called The Last Good Man.
It's coming out in March.
By A.J. Kaczynski, which is a pseudonym or a pen name, of a pair of Danish screenwriters. So watch for that one.
It's a suspense really good book, a thriller. It's really good and quite different. So I had a lot of fun translating it, and now the authors are working on their second book, and I can't wait to get it.
Did you have an active collaboration with them?
They did answer my emails, so that was very good.
At least.
They answered my questions, yes.
Yeah. All right, well, what if, you know, as was done with Gone with the Wind, someone came to you and said, would you write the English version from scratch of the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th Stieg Larsson novels? Would you take that on?
No.
Okay.
When I finished translating the third one, I said, I am into this guy's style now. I think I'll start on the fourth one. And I sat down and I said, well, let's see. We'll start with Lisbeth. Where is she? What is she doing? I couldn't think of a thing. So
that's a perfect way to end.
Exactly.
The art of translation versus the art of writing the novel.
Exactly.
Once again, thanks to Stephen Murray and Tina Nunnally and also Sedge Thompson for his great interview. And thus ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 108th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.